the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
It's the 31st episode of Civitalk. We're going to wade into State of the State by Governor Cooper last night. And of course, Cooper wants more government spending, not a big surprise. We'll touch on some of the national stories today, judicial activism in North Carolina, and we're going to wade in on the very important topic, first of all, of Oscar attire.
First, did you watch the Oscars?
Of course not. I haven't watched the Oscars since 1994 when Braveheart, and not I do like Braveheart, but that was the last time that I watched the Oscars, I think, at least all the way through was 1994 when Braveheart won. Yeah.
Well, so, I'm judging you, but okay.
I'm more into the old movies than a lot of the modern movies.
Are
you into these today movies? Because to me, there's not that many that are good.
There are some that are good. But yeah, to be honest, I mean, Hollywood still leaves a lot to be desired when it comes to some of the new movies that are being released. But there were a couple of good ones.
Are there? I always feel like I have these great movie ideas and I don't understand why they can't be made into movies.
I don't know. Well, you know what? If you had your own production crew, you could.
That's true.
But you know, one of the really good movies this year was Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. That's the animated Spider-Man.
Are you being satirical or are you being serious?
I'm being serious.
Okay. I'm just not into superhero stuff.
Ray, what are you into?
Like, I do like military history. If a film is something about military history, I'll probably enjoy it if it's done well.
I do like
love stories if they're done well. Yeah, biopic pieces I think can do well on the big screen. I just like storytelling. I don't really necessarily like the fictional escapism as much. I like stuff that's a little more real to life.
No, I like Hunger Games, Divergent, dystopian things
like that.
Yeah,
so like all dystopian stuff.
Like all this, let's save the universe and everything depends on our decisions today. Kind of like AOC's New Green Deal. They need to make a movie out of her because she's saving the planet.
Oh, I think they'll make a movie out of her at some point. She's this very mythological figure for the left right now, so kind of a hero. They'll make a movie of her at some point.
Totally.
It took them a long time to do the Ruth Bader Ginsburg movie, but I don't think it'll take that long for AOC.
Probably not. But anyways, okay, I want to know what you would wear to the Oscars if you actually got invited.
Probably a tuxedo. Probably a classic kind of Ralph Lauren style tuxedo. Nothing, you know, I may do the man dress. I don't know.
I was about to say, like, nowadays you need to define what you mean by tuxedo because somebody was rocking a tuxedo gown, velvet hoop skirt.
Maybe
one,
I did the t-shirt tuxedo.
A t-shirt tuxedo.
You know what would be good if a woman wore something like from the 19th century, one of those like Southern Belle gowns. That would be kind of cool. That'd be different.
It would be different.
You know, something maybe from Gone with the Wind. Maybe an actual dress from Gone with the Wind, which is a great film.
That would be neat. That would be neat. But I saw some of the fashion choices that some of the female actresses made, and I really liked J-Lo's dress, and it was tasteful.
What does J-Lo stand for?
Jennifer Lopez.
Okay. That's what I thought. I just wasn't sure.
Yeah. So hers was like this disco ball kind of dress. So it was a mirror dress, but, you know, it was tasteful still and looked nice, and I liked it. It was like whichever way you turn, you're probably going to need glasses, or the people that are looking at you might need glasses. Another person that dressed really nice was Helen Mirren.
She did a good job as the queen.
Yeah, she's very, very classy. Yeah. So I loved her style. But the man dress really, really threw me off. I was so grossed out.
As a woman, do you see that? And you don't go, maybe that could be appealing or charming or something.
You want my one-word answer or my two-word answer?
Two-word answer.
I'm not going to do that on the radio. No. There is nothing about that seems appealing. And yet this man kept being applauded, at least in the Twitterverse.
Well, he's brave.
It's not really brave when everybody throws that word out
so funny. He's like, anything's brave if you affirm the culture, the sort of the culture rot that's going out. It's brave.
Yeah, so anyways, I thought there were some great Oscar dress choices and some misses, and that velvet tuxedo gown was definitely a miss. But let's go ahead and talk about the State of the State from last night.
Yeah, that's a
good
idea.
You and I both watched it.
I was in the Kitty Hawk Club.
Yes, so that's our exclusive Civitas Facebook group for those that have applied. If you have not received an acceptance yet, go ahead and make sure you fill out those questions that have been asked so that you can join. And if you're new to our Civitas Facebook audience, just go and look for groups under our homepage tab on the left-hand side, and you can request to join
the
Kitty
Hawk
Club.
It's a cool club. Yeah, and that exclusive feel definitely gives it a sort of an aura.
Yeah,
kind of.
Yeah, and we
get a little bonus
party
stuff in there.
You do. You get some extra interaction.
Maybe some of the Civitas gossip sort of stuff can percolate into the Kitty Hawk Club.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Good teaser there, Ray. Okay, yeah. So what were some of your thoughts on the State of the State?
Well, ever since I moved to North Carolina and saw Cooper speak, I've always been, this guy's really boring. So I thought his delivery was a little bit better. I heard that he had practiced like 6 or 7 times over at the General Assembly the other day. And so I thought his delivery was a little bit better. It was a little less like where he was speaking to you like you were a kindergartner. But I think the thing that was a little bit frustrating, well, a lot frustrating really, was that he just continued on this tax and spend mantra. And that's really been a broken down, I think, style of ideas now for 60, 80 years almost, where we just look to government to continue to harvest programs and to harvest more spending and harvest more of the tax dollars from the private sector into the public sector. And it's really a broken model. And I wrote a little bit about this today on the blog. You can check that out right on our front page at nccivitas.org. But to me, it's not surprising, though, too. I mean, this is what Cooper is. I mean, Leah wrote a piece soon after she got on here at Civitas about his record in the General Assembly in supporting tax hikes. So that's not new. And Cooper, I mean, I think the people around Cooper and Cooper's allies believe that this state is getting more and more progressive, that eventually his ideas are going to win out, this whole notion that we just have to look more and more to government, less to the private sector, less to free enterprise, less to freedom, where individuals are making the decisions in their lives, and instead just look to government. And that's really a broken model. I think the federal government has proved that by their $22 trillion of debt that has really broken this nation and is going to cripple it. So I think for North Carolina to go to that model and also to go to the model that they did before the Republican takeover of the General Assembly, which has set us on a much different path, is a broken model, which Cooper is still championing.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. And I would say if you're going to take away anything from last night, it really was what you touched on, which is a call for bigger government and more spending. And how can it not be that way when you begin to view government as the answer to any societal ailment?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, history continues to prove to us that this is not the correct answer, that it will always yield less than desirable results when government intervenes on these things, especially when it's stuff that should be handled at the civil society level. And yet, the progressives in the state continue to champion these ideas, whether it's Medicaid expansion, which was one thing that Cooper really harped on, these school bonds, he talked about that, building more and more schools. Yet in Wake County, the traditional public school system only added 42 additional students, despite how much Wake County is growing. A fraction of them are actually choosing to go to a traditional public school. And so it's this whole idea behind some of the proposals that Governor Cooper and others have brought forward is that North Carolinians aren't responsible or educated enough to make their own decisions about how their money should be spent or where their children should go to school. And I think last night's State of the Union just reinforced that. So although his intentions may be good, the policy proposals just on their face are going to fall flat if we actually implement them, because we've seen what happened before in 2011 or pre-2011, and the tax reforms that have come as a result of conservative policies have made all the difference and actually put us in a really, really good position tax-wise.
No, that's exactly right, Brooke. And one of the things that interested me about the speech, too, was his mention of the bond, because I think that, you know, bonds on education tend to be popular with the general public. And one thing that worries me with is that a bond is essentially a tax increase that's deferred. And it's a way, I think, where Cooper can straddle the tax argument a little bit, and he can mitigate maybe some future tax decreases by supporting and floating a big bond, because that would have an impact on, you know, our future ability to cut taxes here in North Carolina. And on top of that, you know, I'm for this model of pay-go, where you just pay as you go. You mm-hmm. pay for things as you go, and you find room in the general revenue of the budget to pay for things. And so that's something that I think North Carolina has to think about at a deep level, and you know, because there's always a temptation to pay for something later, but that will have an impact on future growth, future economic growth, future ability to really for a lot of citizens to flourish in the state and to keep more of their property.
You know, I wonder if with the growth of debt, especially consumer debt like credit card and then even student loans and things like that, this whole pay as you go idea and concept is very foreign just at a personal level for many Americans, and obviously it is at the state and federal levels too. State level, not so much. We've got this rainy day fund that we should be proud of and that we've thankfully has helped us during hurricanes and things like that, but it's just Americans are increasingly becoming disconnected from actually what they spend. It's just like charge it.
Right.
And so that is one of the disadvantages to walking away from a cash society. Not that that was always the best either. Some people would advocate for the gold standard. I think that there is something to be said about just us being a little bit more intentional with how we spend our money at this government level and even a personal level.
Absolutely. I mean, we are living in a culture of debt. Like you said, the student loan crisis has reached epic proportions. More people are defaulting on their student loans than ever before in the history of this nation. And, you know, the credit card debt is uncontrollable in many families and many swaths of society. When you look at those factors, I think it's just a part of our culture, sort of the here and now. We live for the here and now, so to speak. We don't really have eternal perspective or a long-term perspective. You know, it's detrimental to society and it's detrimental to the family. And it's not something that I think will change, like you said, Brooke, unless we have sort of a cultural change on this issue. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there's really been no consequences for many in Congress for the amount of spending. You know, some people will rail against Congress, but they usually won't vote their congressman out. They still get reelected at like a 92 or 93% clip. So there's just little turnover there. And there's no really ability, I feel like, to reform the system as is now. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
it's setting up for a lot of trouble.
Yeah, there's not a good incentive in place right now for Congress to get their act together, because like you said, we're not holding them accountable as we ought. But let's go ahead and pivot, because there's another really important topic that we need to discuss here, because it's something that's really important to the Civitas audience, and that's related to voter ID and the income tax cap amendments. And so a judge in Wake County, Judge Collins is his name. He issued a late Friday ruling determining that the voter ID constitutional amendment, as well as the income tax one, were unconstitutional. And this was something that we knew that a lawsuit sure. had already been filed back in December by Southern Coalition for Social Justice.
And the NAACP, right? They were involved in the
lawsuit.
They
filed one at the federal level.
Okay.
But the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, if you'll remember, their founding or one of their founders is Anita Earls, and she was just elected to the North Carolina Supreme Court. Isn't that interesting?
That is.
So anyways, this judge, though, at the Superior Court level, he determined that because North Carolina's General Assembly is so gerrymandered that they don't truly represent the state's electorate, therefore these rulings or these constitutional amendments, which were voted for by the people, are...
But only two of the constitutional amendments were barred.
He ruled them as unconstitutional, but you're right. Only
That's
two of them.
Bizarre to me.
Yeah, so...
Is it only because that the two were brought forward and challenged, and so he couldn't rule on the other two? I don't understand how that works from a legal perspective.
Yeah, I think that is the case right there, because Southern Coalition for Social Justice only
challenged those two amendments.
However, by his logic, though, that would essentially clear out any sort of legislation that's been passed since...
Yeah, I mean, you open up a huge can of worms there. And
well, and also gerrymandering is, what, 100 years plus?
Oh,
like, it's
easily,
been happening
at least over 100 years, yeah. Governor Cooper has been silent on this because he knows it hurts Democrats. You basically have a judge sticking his middle finger up to the people of North Carolina and saying, you that went out to vote and amend our Constitution, follow the process. The General Assembly followed the process to amend the Constitution. The people went out and voted for these four amendments. They were wise voters, too. They rejected two of the amendments that some saw as power grabs by Republicans in the General Assembly. So they did their homework and rejected two of them and voted to support four of them, including the voter ID, which was ruled on, was thrown out. And also, what was the other one?
I'm sorry, voter ID, income tax cap.
The income tax cap.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
Sorry.
So that was ruled that was thrown out by the judge because of gerrymandering. And, you know, what I just thought about it was the way he just actually stuck his middle finger up at the people of this state and said, look, the power flows out from me, the government, this judicial tyranny, this little box of judicial tyranny. It doesn't flow from the people. So the people don't really have the ability to amend their constitution in this instance, even when they follow the process and they follow the law. So I think it's a huge problem. It's going to be a huge problem for Democrats. You've had some Democrats on the, like, I think Senator Jeff Jackson and others who are saying this decision was wrong. I think that's the right way to handle it. I mean, it's clearly wrong. It's clearly, I think, going to be overturned at some point just because it's so egregious. But it'll be interesting to see if it's the federal courts that have any say in this, or it's just the North Carolina State Constitution or the North Carolina Supreme Court and what they rule on this. And, you know, in that situation, it may not be as clear or black and white there.
It's Pandora's box, in my opinion. Just opening that sort of reasoning up and actually giving it credence is very concerning, because it's just whatever we don't like that's passed just arbitrarily, that's going, oh, that was the result of a gerrymandered legislature, so it doesn't count. But these ones that we do like, you know, it's totally arbitrary, and that's not
what law is. It's judicial rule by fiat, and it's tyranny, because what you've done is taken the power away from the people, placed it in the judiciary. And so, I mean, this is the quintessential example of judicial activism. And in a way, when I first saw it, I was like, man, this guy's satirizing what the right thinks judicial activism is, because he took a, you know, full throttle and ran with it. And it's almost comical when you read the decision and when you look deeper into this issue to actually say that the people's vote don't matter. They, of course, the people don't have any impact when you have a statewide vote like this on gerrymandering. Right. These things were approved, yes, by the legislature, but to pick and choose,
it's,
you know,
a popular
laws,
vote on the
amendment. Yeah, pick and choose laws by basing it on gerrymandering is totally, totally just irresponsible and a power grab, a partisan power grab by the courts. And so this judge is up for re-election in 2020, and you know, it'll be up to the people to decide what to do with them. So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll keep you guys posted on that, especially because we know that our audience really has a vested interest in this. They care deeply.
Yeah. And you should be mad, Brooke. I mean, I'm mad. I went out and voted for those two amendments, and for a judge to come in and swoop down and say, nope, sorry, doesn't count. I mean, that should make people mad. I mean, you go out and vote, and then your vote is overturned by a judge.
Yeah.
So this has happened before in North Carolina, though. I mean, North Carolina voted for a marriage amendment. This has happened in the past here in this state. So, you know, it's when this is what happens when the judiciary takes control over a state or over the governmental process. Basically, what happens is your vote becomes diluted, whether you're voting directly or voting for your legislatures. They are now the arbitrators. They are now the legislatures. And what it does is dilutes the power of the people. And it will continue to happen in North Carolina unless thankfully, a lot of the judges are up for elections in North Carolina. So people have to go out and they're going to have to do the research. They're going to have to get fired up and enthused about voting for these judicial races.
Agreed, Ray. Yeah. Let's go ahead and talk about something that's happened at the federal level, though, and that's the Born Alive Infant Protection Act. And so this is something that I went to bed last night just heavy on my mind.
Yeah.
I know you probably did, too. And Senator Sass, Ben Sass, one of my favorites, he just makes so much sense. It's absurd, right? In the wake of Governor Northam of Virginia's comments regarding infanticide, Senator Sass said, okay, well, let's produce some just common sense legislation that if a child is born despite or as a result of a botched abortion, so even though the mother attempted an abortion, the child was still born alive, that the doctors would be required to give this child medical treatment just like they would any other U.S. citizen,
right,
or American or a born person, excuse me. But yesterday when the vote was taken, six of those that are running for president on the Democratic ticket voted against this Protection Act. I read the piece of legislation. It's pretty short, and it was just as plain as day. Yet Planned Parenthood and those on the left continued to insist that this had to do with restricting abortion rights. I can't even get my mind around that. It's just like they refuse to see the distinct difference between just this baby is sitting on a table by him or herself.
Yeah, I mean, there's a Hippocratic Oath there, right? To if you're a doctor, to cause no harm and do the patient well. So, I mean, from that aspect, when you look at it from the Hippocratic Oath, how could a doctor just stand there and do nothing?
Yeah, and I think what they are hiding behind, well, there's two things they're hiding behind. They're saying, A, this is just an attempt to restrict abortion, which is...
Right.
Again,
they were told by Planned Parenthood to vote against this, so that was one of the reasons.
Planned Parenthood's got a great pack, right? I mean, they dole out campaign dollars.
They got
like
a lot of money
condoms
to throw around.
But then also, another thing is that this is just progressivism at its heart, right? Like, progressivism on the in this sense, when it comes to social issues like this, it never is satisfied to just absorb one particular sphere or area.
Right.
Which is also the problem with reparations, which is another conversation we were talking about having. It's that it will constantly progress past the normal boundaries and these norms and values that the society at large holds. And it will continue to push for more and more and more power and control. And that's just the way it is when it comes to this. So not only were they okay with abortions up to 12 weeks, then it had to move over to 20 weeks, then 30, 36, and now 40 weeks. And now, oh, well, the baby was born, but was the baby really wanted?
Right.
I guess we can have that conversation now. And that's just at the root of progressivism when it's unhinged from moral truths.
Yeah, I mean, the Lord your God of progressivism is a jealous God, and he doesn't want to compete with a higher power. And you're exactly right, Brooke. I mean, for me, just kind of looking at this, it's such a low moral bar that we asked these senators to pass, and they couldn't even do that. So that aspect, I mean, the fundamental right to life, as Jefferson said, is self-evident. And I think one of the things that when you just sort of kind of look at this, it just shows you the moral chaos and the moral delusion that so many, not just in Washington, but across the country, are under today. And so it's very disheartening. It's very tragic. An infant is there, right? An infant, an actual person. And to say that you couldn't help them or you should let them die is barbaric. And, it shouldn't be any part of any civilized society. So it does show you the end results of progressivism and what it means. It ultimately means death, because what it does is it swallows itself up and it eats itself. And it only hinges upon more power. And this is what it means for Planned Parenthood is consolidating more power, for pushing their agenda more, and for this quest of killing a child a born child. And so when you look at that, it's just completely disheartening, and it's a lot to take in. I mean, it's a depressing state where we're in, I think, from a moral standpoint, and it's hard to see it getting better outside of just sort of a vast revival or something, just mm-hmm. a huge cultural change, because we're dug in so much now in our camps and our divisions now. And I think you're going to see more of this polarization and more extremism, especially by the left, on these issues. So, from that aspect, it's not a lot of good news, Brooke, in that respect.
It also, progressivism, since we're railing on it anyways, and I think rightfully so, it deserves this, it doesn't create anything, right? And
right.
So, like you were talking about, it's this all-consuming, jealous God. And its intentions, whether people that subscribe to it realize this or not, it's not centered around creation. It's centered around destruction, destroying the patriarchy, destroying, a child's right to live, because all in the name of a woman's right to choose, mind you. I mean, so they're great at, they're masterful messengers. But it's always built on this idea that what exists is not good. There's nothing good within it. And so it deserves destruction, which actually speaks to something that, okay.
Well, I was just going to say, what it fundamentally says, and I was trying to say this before, but just didn't say it as well, is it fundamentally says that the human person is below the power of the state. The human person is now a slave to the laws of the state. The state says we can kill you. The state says we can do this to you. We will not give you medical treatment. If you're there flailing on the table and you survived an abortion, we will leave you there to die. And what the state is saying is you are subservient to them. You are subservient to their laws. There's no higher moral code. There's no higher moral law to act here. And that's a very dangerous place to take this country. That's a very dangerous society to live in. I mean, that's a the end result of totalitarian regimes. And it's sad to see in such a great country that we live in. Brooke, I mean, this is controversial to say, but I was a very patriotic person growing up, love this country, still do. But that patriotism begins to wane and fade as the sort of the moral rot reaches into this nation, because what are you saying about our country? And sort of I don't mean worship the country, but you look up to your country, but it's hard to look up to a country that would let an infant die,
right?
It's hard to joyously sing the national anthem or the Pledge of Allegiance, and I do those things, so I'm not dismissing that at all, but you lose a little sense of that fabric of patriotism when you live in a state or a nation that basically says it's okay, or we condone this killing of an infant. And to me, I mean, that's in the gospel, that's what I think of when I think of the least of these, right? When Jesus calls people to protect those that are the least of these. Those are the little children. Those are the little babies. They're so vulnerable. They're just lying there, and they're crying out for help, and that you would just leave them to their own fate without any help, to me, is it's crippling. It's crippling. Yeah, it's a moral evil, and it's despicable that we have people in our government that would do that. Outside of their usual position on abortion, they're taking it to a whole nother level.
Right, and they're hiding behind, this is an expansion of abortion. Like, they're just so blinded to this. I would choose to believe that they're blinded unless they're willfully recognizing what they're doing and still going forward with it. I don't know, but it's one of those things that we need to sober up about and realize what's really going on. These are elected officials. Six of them are running for the highest office of the land right now. And if they don't get held accountable for these kind of actions, the way that the conservatives and pro-lifers held Northam accountable, like they brought hellfire and fury on Northam, at least, with these scathing articles, I hope that we do the same thing with these people that are advocating for killing infants.
Yeah.
So this should be a no-brainer, people.
But in more positive news, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said that you can't have too many children. So you need to really think about...
She said you shouldn't...
She said you shouldn't have any, or she said... just a few. I forgot her exact comment.
This is what she said, okay? She was on Twitter, and she says, there's scientific consensus that the lives of children are going to be very difficult, and it does lead young people, I think, to have a legitimate question. Is it okay to still have children?
Yeah, so she begged the question or sort of attacked the premise of having children.
Yeah.
So which child would you give up, Brooke? I want names. which Never. Child will you give to the state for in the name of climate change?
Between me and my babies, and there's going to be hell to pay. No, but really, to me, when I was thinking about this, I'm like, this is a new form of an old record, and that's Malthusianism.
Right.
And so Thomas Malthus.
Can I say one little thing?
Okay.
But don't you, we were talking about abortion, don't you find it a little bit ironic with this whole my body, my choice now? And it's almost like she's saying, you know, she's providing a choice on that. She's sort of being a little bit hypocritical. It's your body, your choice, but she's kind of saying, well, if you want to have lots of kids.
Let's lead you to the choice you want.
Yeah, let's lead
well,
us to this, that was where they this stood progressive choice. Anyways, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
But this goes, thanks, Ray. Totally lost it. No, but this goes back to that idea that progressivism destroys things in its path. It doesn't create. So right. It's natural, right, for them to expect, oh, of course, well, why would we want to bring in children to this world like this? Climate, you know, they're going to just produce more greenhouse gases. I don't know. But really at the heart of this is, like I said, this Malthusianism, where it's this idea that people are inconvenient. Their lives are not worth living unless we, the state, or we, the ruling elite, determine that their lives are worth living. I mean, we see this evidenced all over, and you'll see it by push with death with dignity laws, which is a complete misnomer.
Right.
So that's assisted suicide. You see it in the abortion. Now you see it in the new Green Deal. We're going to kill cows off because we don't want cow farts. And then we're also going to encourage you not to have any more children because, heaven forbid, they contribute to this climate change that we're so convinced is going to destroy the earth in 12 years anyways. And it's heartbreaking, but also just like, I'm flabbergasted. You wonder, can they continue to descend to these new depths? And oh, they surprise you, and they do.
Yep.
And to have a 29-year-old woman who doesn't have any children, who, I mean, I'm sure she has family members and has been touched in some way by an interaction with a child, but to have her propose something like that, to me, is completely out of touch with the millions of Americans that invest their everything into taking care of their children. And just, it's an affront to them.
Yeah, you've seen all these things on social media. I know you've seen them, Brooke. These people, these progressives will get on social media. I think there was one in Huffington Post and maybe Vox. And it talks about, well, you'll spend $2 million on your children or $500,000. And this is how much money you'll have without your kids. Like, they're material beings that you can put a price tag on a child, you know.
Yep.
They say you'll have so much more productivity and happiness if you don't have a child. And you'll be able to take trips to Europe or China or wherever. If you don't have a child, I know it's
and
so
narcissistic.
Right.
Like,
it's so materialist.
About me, just about me.
So
makes me mad.
Yeah, it is. It's a very secular way of looking at things. It's a very utilitarian way of looking at things, and it's comical because if you look at your kids, I mean, anybody that's a parent out there would not take money. Anybody sane or rational and that really loves their kid would not take a check for their child. I mean, so their argument is null and void. And it's comical to see sometimes that they don't even realize what they're doing. They don't even realize how they sound sometimes and how moronic it sounds.
This is the far left, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
I mean,
we could talk about the far left all day. It's scary.
It is. But yet it's mainstreaming. I mean,
yeah,
these
is.
People are getting platforms. They're getting elected to office. They're getting tons of media time and fawning on Instagram. They're influencers. And these are the kind of ideas they peddle. I am just... Again, I said it already. I'm flabbergasted.
We should do a show where we read some of the quotes from the Democrats that ran for president in 1900 or say 1924 against some of these Democrats that are running for president. I think it'll be a fun show. We have quotes from each era. I've done a few writings on this of just presidential candidates from the past. And there's some conservative Democrats. It'd just be funny to do a little comparison some of these candidates from then to now. John Davis was who ran against Coolidge. I think it was in 1924. I mean, he was a conservative. I mean, he ran against another conservative, Coolidge. There was a time in history where you had two conservatives running for president. And it was an interesting election. And it was a fun election for a lot of people because the country was in a lot different, probably a lot better state morally. It certainly wasn't as rich in some ways or technologically advanced, but it was certainly in a better state morally.
We camped on this for a while, but it was worthwhile and it needed to be said. But we're out of time for this week's episode. So thank you guys so much for joining us. And if you're watching this later, feel free to go ahead and leave comments at that time and we will respond to them. If you haven't yet, subscribe to us on iTunes or Google Play. Just look for Civitalk and shoot us an email at radio@nccivitas.org. And thank you guys for joining us.